We started our study last week of what I've called a summary verse, 1 Thessalonians 5:23 and 24, but 24 is a promise, 23 is actually explanation of Paul's desires for them. And in our study, we really zeroed in on the question of how do we identify what is a spirit, what is a soul, what is a body. We spent a little bit of time on that. Mostly we spent our time just arguing for the thesis that this is a summary verse, which means, as such, we will find the truthfulness of it all the way through the scriptures. And we tried to make our case that way. The issue is, however, that there are three aspects of our sanctification according to the verse: spirit, soul, and body. And given that reality, I made the claim last time, focusing in on the issue of the nephesh or the psuche, that's the Hebrew and Greek for soul, raising the issue of just what is it? Because there's an enormous amount of confusion out there about what is the nephesh or the psuche. And the problem is that there's just been a lot of just dismissing. Well, you know, and just blow it off. And you don't really learn anything doing that. So in my study, I made the claim that the original nephesh was a part of our physical body. And I misstated, fortunately for those who were listening and not watching, they couldn't see what I said. They could only hear what I said. So they didn't know that I missed it. I said the nephesh is this part of your body. But I should have started up here, because the category that identifies the problems in the soul, above the eyes, because the issue is the lust of the eyes. Why I missed that, I don't know. I have no idea how I missed that. If it's the lust of eyes, then obviously if that relates to the soul, it's got to start above your eyes. And then there is a statement that the rebels in the wilderness said, our nephesh despises this food, talking about the manna. If you take that in any kind of literal sense, it means they hated to put it in their mouth, and it tasted awful to them. Now, I realize you can go off in spiritual stuff and say, my soul loathes this food, meaning something non-physical. But why? Because also in the Old Testament, the nephesh is identified as that part of your body, which includes your nose and your mouth and your throat and the air passages that go into your lungs. I'm not sure that the nephesh includes the lungs, but it might. I haven't decided on that. But nonetheless, the nephesh is from above your eyes down at least to the bottom of your neck, because those are the things that the scriptures tie physically. As cold water is to the nephesh, so is good news to the person who needs it. The whole idea of cold water, it fits your mouth. It doesn't fit any other part of your body. But if you take it as a literal statement, then the nephesh has to be this part of your physical body from above your eyes to at least the bottom of your throat. And there are a few other references like that, that if you take them literally, it's very obvious that he's talking about the part of the body where you inhale and exhale, you taste, you react. If the water goes over your nephesh, you will drown. Those kind of statements. And granted, a lot of the references to nephesh are not in the physical realm, because the scriptures use the physical to push us in the direction of the relational. I mean, God created two universes. I've said this over and over. A physical one and a relational one. The physical one is the shadow reality, where you find the illustrations of what is the reality in the relational realm. They're not two different realities, because the physical is just as real as not. But the real issues of our function of life and the experience of life is not physical. It's relational. Therefore, the physical universe provides a foundation for understanding the relational universe. And that's why I think it's very important for us to be able to identify the nephesh as from above your eyes to the bottom of your throat, because that tells us an awful lot of stuff about what that might imply in terms of relational things. For example, the psalmist says, as the deer, who's so terribly thirsty, pants for the water brooks, where's the deer thirsty? Well, all over his whole body, but where's he gonna feel the assuaging of the thirst? In his mouth and throat and all that. So, in a likeness like that, so my nephesh pants after thee, O God. Well, that's obviously not a physical reality, because you can't taste God, can't drink him. But it is a very clear analogy between the thirst that's physical and a real thirst that's relational. And anybody that's ever had a relationship that meant a lot to them, interrupted for any reason, knows what the thirst of the soul is like. And there's this kind of empty, hollow, dissatisfaction feeling. So, given that, I just want us to be aware of the fact that in our identification of the nephesh, it's from above your eyes to at least the bottom of your throat. Now, that'll get more important when we actually get into that, a study of that, in the weeks to come. We're not there yet. This is a long verse in terms of what it contains. One thing, though, that I want to make an observation about. In the book of Galatians, when we spent that, 3.5 years in study Galatians, the whole issue there is an issue of, I believe, the spirit problem that man has. Because the spirit seems to be the area where man longs for status and approbation, getting compliments and not being embarrassed or humiliated or scolded or whatever. And the whole book is about how you come to get this kind of approval from God, and is it by works of the law or by the hearing of faith? So in a sense, the book of Galatians is God's, or is Paul's treatise on dealing with the issue of the Spirit. 1 and 2 Thessalonians come right along on the heels of that, dealing with the issues of the soul, which has to do with the hope. So, and I'm going to try to demonstrate that this evening from the text, but I really believe that Paul wrote Galatians because men were in a spiritual area of serious, serious difficulty. And he wrote the Thessalonians, both letters, because there were some people trying to confuse the Thessalonians about the hope. And that's an issue of the soul. And we'll see more of that as we go. So, having said those things as a kind of introductory thing, this evening what we're going to do is we're going to look at the wishes that Paul expresses in verse 23. He actually makes two wishes, says two things that are in the optative mood, which means they're wishes. One of them is, may the God of peace himself sanctify you. And then, may your spirit and soul and body be preserved complete without blame. So, may God sanctify you and may you be preserved. So the issue of sanctification and preservation are the two wishes that Paul is expressing in this verse. But he does it in such a way that it's not at all unclear as to what he is driving at. The problem is that the translations don't make it as clear as Paul made it when he wrote it. For example, in verse 23, the New American Standard says, may the God of peace himself sanctify you entirely. What do you mean, entirely? And then, may your spirit and soul and body be preserved complete. What's the difference between entirely and completely? Well, there's a difference, but we'll see it as we go into it this evening. But I wanted you to be aware that what Paul is doing in verse 23 has a fairly large theological backdrop that I think are expressed in the word that's translated entirely and then in the word that's translated complete. So that's where we're headed. In the New American Standard, in verse 23, the sanctification wish is that it'll be entire. That God will sanctify you entirely. Well, what kind of an implication does that bring to the table? That you'll be completely sanctified, spirit, soul, and body, so that by the end of your life you'll be functionally sinless? If that's what it means, what does verse 24 mean when it says, faithful is he who calls you who also will bring it to pass. And what does that mean when you sit back and you observe a lot of people who've been believers for a long, long time and they're not even close to being entirely sanctified, spirit, soul, or body? So, I hope you see a little bit of the conundrum that we face with our translation. The sanctify entirely has actually led into a doctrine called entire sanctification. And there are two branches of that idea. One of them is biblical, that is, since Jesus Christ is our sanctification, we are entirely sanctified in Him, and we can't get it. We can't improve on that. But then there is that other branch of theology that says, God has sanctified me entirely so that I never sin anymore. Which is, I mean, you really got to be self-deluded to a maximum level of self-delusion to not be able to see how often you sin. I'm not the only sinner in the room or in the world. And entire sanctification is an error in that regard because they missed the word here. And the idea of being preserved complete, what about having your body preserved complete? Does that mean you'll never fall overboard and a shark bite your arm off? Or what? So, these are the two words we're going to really look at because these, I think, give us the backdrop for Paul's two wishes. The sanctification has a background. He wants that for them. The preservation has a backdrop. He wants that for them. But what does he want for them? Well, the interesting thing about the word translated entirely in the first part of the verse, that's in the New American Standard. The Authorized Version, the King James, says holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y. We actually get our word whole, W-H-O-L-E, from the Greek word that's used in the first of this word, halas. Halas and hala, holy, that just depends on how you pronounce the vowels. But the point is, this word in verse 23, entirely, and I'm assuming the New American Standard here when I say that, this word is a combination word. It's built off of two words. This is the only time the New Testament is ever found. But fortunately for us, both of the words that it comes from, the two words that Paul put together here to make this word, both are used widely in the New Testament. So there's really no question about what halas means, and there's really no question about what telos means. Because the hala telos is the word here that's used, translated entirely. And basically the translators just took the front end of the word, the halas, and translated the word as if it didn't have a combination, didn't have an addition to it. For example, the word halas, which is the first part of the combination, is used when it says the gospel went through all Macedonia. What does that mean? It went through the entire region. That's why entirely is a fairly good translation of halas. But it's not a very good translation of this combination word because it's only a translation of the first part. It just leaves the telos off. And that you can't do. I realize that you can't really build a lot of understanding of a word just out of its etymology, how it came to be put together. But when Paul puts two words together one time in the whole New Testament, I think you're pretty safe to think, okay, he put these words together for a reason. They were put together in the culture for a reason. What was the reason? So let's look at the statement in terms of what Paul is doing in verse 23 with the spirit, soul, body concept. This is the totality of you. So the sanctification of you in an entire sense would mean in the area of spirit, in the area of soul, in the area of body. But still it doesn't tell us really what God has committed himself, according to verse 24, to do. Has he committed himself to bringing us to some kind of moral perfection before we die? Is that what he's committed to doing? Is our brokenness actually going to be fixed in this world? Or not? Well, I'm going to argue that the answer is no, that's not the right understanding. And the reason that I'm going to argue that way is because The word halas is used when something is considered entirely. And you can say throughout. The gospel was preached throughout Macedonia or through all of Macedonia, entirely, covering the entire area. And it's translated by our word all in a majority of the cases in the Authorized Version. In other words, halas is all, or every part, or something along that line. That's really the sense of the word halas in our context. Because what Paul is talking about is being sanctified in relation to a halas telos. And the halas is the whole thing. So to go ahead and talk about spirit, soul, and body being that which is the complete you, that fits the idea of all or throughout or comprehensively. But the... Let me just say this. Paul is addressing the issue of God's work of sanctification in the lives of his children. That's what he's asking. May the God of peace himself sanctify you. Halatelos. So, the sanctification issue is a question of what has God committed himself to doing in this world with his children as long as they're in this world? And how do you reconcile his commitment to them with 1 Corinthians 11, for example, where some of his children rebel to the point where he has to cut their lives short in order to keep them from being condemned to the world? Does that sound like entire sanctification? Does it sound like progress? Does it sound like God has made a commitment to progress or what? That's the issue, because what is God's commitment to sanctifying his children? And I believe that the issue of sanctification is the issue of God going through a person's values and beliefs and adjusting them so that the person can become a greater reflection of God's own sanctification or holiness. The word sanctify is related to the word holy. So that the process of sanctification would be something like this. God saves us, and we're a brand new child of God, and he sees that we value a whole gob of things that are not valuable. And we believe a whole host of stuff that's not true. So in order to sanctify us, he takes one of those things that we value, and he takes us through some kind of a process that shows us that that's not valuable. Simultaneously, he probably is showing us something that is. So that he's going to replace something that's not valuable with something that is valuable. And that's absolutely essential to any sense of sanctification. Your values have got to change. The heart has got to be altered. The essence of the new covenant is that God is going to write his law on our hearts, so our hearts will be new. There'll be a different type of heart than we have now. It won't be a deceitful heart full of desperate wickedness, but it will be a new heart where the law is written on hearts of flesh, and we will do the will of God, and we will be the children of God. So any sense of sanctification has to have that in mind, that God is addressing the things that we value that are not valuable and replacing them with things that are. And it's a big job because we value gazillion things at various levels of value, from a penny to a cat to a house, to, you just name it. Your life is full of stuff. And all of it fits into your value system somewhere. But an enormous amount of that value system is all balled up. It's not true. The things are not valuable. Peter kind of made that pretty blatantly clear when he said, all this stuff's going to burn, so what kind of people should we be? I mean, why do you value something that's going to burn? So, through the scriptures, we're constantly being challenged with things that we consider to be valuable that are simply not. Well, for example, is it a value to keep from being humiliated? Well, most people say, absolutely. I hate to be humiliated. I hold that very high in my value. Does God consider it to be a real high value in your system to not be humiliated? No. He doesn't think being humiliated is a problem at all. None. So to him, all of the reasons why we would try to get out of being humiliated, all of that effort's wasted because you're trying to get out of something that's not valuable at all. And Jesus even made this statement. What men value, God despises. So I'm making quite a thing about this love business, but I could make the same case with the faith things, the things we believe, the things we're committed to. This will work. If I do this, this will work. If I do that, this will work. I believe this will, you know, because faith is the methodological process. Love is what you're chasing, and faith is how you get it. So how many things do we believe that are not true? And how much, here's the real question. The whole issue of God changing our values and our beliefs so that they are adjusted to provide a greater reflection of his own values and beliefs. How big a process is that? Well, given the number of things that we love and the number of things we believe, it's a massive job. And it's a lifelong process. It has a gazillion details. Because there are a gazillion values and beliefs. Now, let's just suppose that we were going to try to put this into a time frame and ask ourselves this question. How long will it take God to get me to stop valuing this and start believing that the opposite's valuable? Given, you know, how many hours, how many days, how many weeks, in some cases, how many years will it take for God to root this false value out and replace it with a true one? Even if you say, well, he could get that done in a week. Well, okay. How many weeks do you have to live, and how much of your values and beliefs are messed up? Do you have enough weeks for it to work? And I would argue no. The very fact that the process of massive and lifelong means that there are going to be some things that God is simply not going to address. There are going to be some values we hold that He'll never challenge, even though they're worthless. There are going to be some things we believe that are not true, and He'll never challenge it, even though it's a lie. And the reason I'm saying that is because there are too many values and too many beliefs for God to deal with all of them in time, in real sense, of actually altering the heart and the mind to fit. There's too much. So, what does that mean? Well, it means we need to understand the other half of this combination word. The halos is only the front end. That's the whole. That's the all of the loves and all of the beliefs. And but the other half of the word is the word telos. And this is weird. You know, the halotelos. Because the word telos typically is a word that's specifically used to present the end as the final accomplishment to a particular result. In other words, the telos is the objective. That's the end toward which all of this is bent. So the halotelos would mean that God is going to sanctify us through the process to the intended result. That's the way I would translate the verb, or the word. Through the whole process to the intended result. That's the halotelos. God is going to work in sanctifying us in the areas of values and beliefs with a particular objective in mind, and He's going to pursue the process in our lifetime in this world to that end, and that end only. And that's my explanation for why He just totally ignores a whole lot of stuff, because it has nothing to do with that end. I can't say nothing, because all lies and all truth are, you know, they're all connected together. But when I say it has nothing to do with it, it's not the primary. I mean, you can have a whole lot of messed up stuff and still get up to the right end. In the physical world, you can set out any objective. I want to fix the car. In order to fix the car, you got to do this and 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 this. And if you screw up this, you're going to have to do that and that and that to fix what you messed up there. And then once you get that and that and that, you can go back to the this and this and this and this and this. And then you mess up and else up, and you got to stop and go back. And I know whereof I speak. It just took me 3 days, a couple of weeks ago, to do a job that should have taken me about 6 hours. Or maybe 8. If I'd done it all my life, I could have done it in probably four. But I had never done it before. And I messed up here and I messed up there. And did I get the car fixed? That was the telos. The answer is yes. It was a long, windy process. But I got it. It got done. By the grace of God, it got done. But the point that I'm trying to make here is, that's kind of the way God views us. He's got an end in mind, and He's going to be working in our lives, and Paul's desire is that that working will be sanctifying until the intended end has been reached. Now that's a whole lot different than entire sanctification. The issue here is, God has a goal, a particular objective. He's going to achieve it. Verse 24 pretty much establishes that. And Paul's desire is that God will sanctify throughout this process unto this desired end. And the process may actually include a lot of rebellion, a lot of resistance, a lot of whatever. It'll even include 1 Corinthians 11. God never cuts anybody off to keep them from being condemned with the world without having their objective in mind. Because part of His objective is to keep them from being condemned with the world. That's part of it. So He does that to keep that part intact. But He's got some other things in mind too. And Paul's desire is for God to be seen working through the process until you get to the end. Now this second part actually has a lot of biblical support. That telos points to a particular result. Because Paul says, for example, in Philippians 3, 12 and 13, and I knew what that said before I quoted it, but I don't know it now, so I'll look over there at Philippians 3. Yeah, Paul said, "Brethren, I do not regard myself as having laid hold of it yet." It what? God's intended end. "But one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and reaching forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal, the prize of the high calling or the upward call of God in Christ." In other words, Paul recognized that God has a goal that he wants to achieve in Paul's life, and Paul doesn't consider himself as having gotten there yet. But in 2 Timothy 4, 6 and 7, he says, "I've gotten there. I have finished my course." And that's why he's ready to be martyred. "I've finished my course." When I show up before God, he's going to say, "This was the goal I had in mind for you, and this is the goal we reached in your life. Welcome to your intended result." And actually, Romans 3 even chimes in with a kind of perfect harmony, because it says that each one of us ought to be really careful about how we think of ourselves, not more highly than we ought to think, because God has given to each a measure of the faith. And the issue there is that the measure of faith that a person achieves or has in this life is a divine fiat thing given by God, and you can't fault somebody else for an area of weakness if they don't have the faith to handle it, because they don't have it. I mean, you can fault them for it, but they don't have it. It's not going to correct them. And we need to be really careful when we're dealing with one another, because the issues of loves and beliefs are a very tangled up thing. And in dealing with those, we have to realize it has to be a real value. God has to see it as a real value, has to see it as real confidence, or it's not love and faith. So I really do believe that Paul's idea, even in Philippians, he said, "God who began a good work in you will complete it until the day of redemption," or something along that line. And what he's saying is not that you're all going to become perfect, or the inevitable perseverance of the saints is going to mean that if you're really a Christian, you're really going to grow until the final end, because that's the promise of God. Well, that's not the promise of God. 1 Corinthians 11 says so. God wouldn't have to cut you off to keep you from being condemned with the world if you were getting better and better every day. So it's not that's not it. That's completely misconstrued false theology. But what God is doing is with every one of his children. These things are child specific. I don't know how many people are going to inherit in the kingdom of Christ, but there'll be a lot. How many of those people that are going to inherit in the kingdom of God are going to go into that kingdom prepared for the place that God has decided for them? Every one of them. Are there different kinds of jobs in the kingdom? Sure there are. But that leads us right into Paul's wish for the Thessalonians to be sanctified through an ongoing lifelong process so that at the end they will be suitably fitted for the end that God has had in the mind from the beginning. Ephesians 2:10 actually says that. We are His workmanship created in Christ Jesus unto good works which He before ordained that we should walk in them. We are going to end up being what He wants us to be when we get there. Even if we spend a lot of our time in rebellion, it's going to happen. Why? Well, that brings us to the next word. If our sanctification is about a process where there is an intended end in view, what about this business about you, that is, your spirit, soul, and body, being preserved complete? What does he mean? Well, lo and behold, this is the second part of the backdrop. It's a combination word. It's used one time in the New Testament. The first part of the combination is halas. Same exact beginning word. Throughout. Process throughout. But the second word is different. Because in the second part, the word is kleros. In other words, sanctification is halas telos. And preservation is halas kleros. Well, I could say, repeat all the stuff I've already said about halas all over again, but it would be fruitless. I mean, we've already covered that. It means the entire process, going through this entire thing until you get to the telos. Well, now let's put that with the kleros. Halas means working through the whole process to a kleros. What's the kleros? Well, interestingly, the kleros is one of two things. It's either the lot that is cast, or it's the outcome of the casting of that lot, so that you end up with something. In other words, the kleros is either the lot that's cast into the lap, the disposing of which is of the Lord. So the kleros could be the dice that you throw. But the kleros also shifts over in some of the uses to the word inheritance. And the reason it's translated that way is because this is what you get out of it. If you are shooting craps with somebody and there's a pile of money on the table there, and if you come up with a six or whatever, you get the money, and you cast the lot and it comes up six, you get the money. That's the kleros. So you cast the kleros and you get the kleros. In other words, you cast the lot and you get what the lot has determined you get. Because that's what the casting of the lot was for, is to decide what you get. Well, when you think about that in terms of the theology of Paul and Peter and the rest of the New Testament, Paul's theology includes this really weird idea of God casting lots. It's an anthropomorphism. I mean, God doesn't have to cast lots to decide things. But that's the word that's used. And it has to do with to see who gets to be in the place they are in the final distribution of all things. You have obtained your precious faith by lot, Peter says, casting a lot. It's an interesting idea because the whole idea of a kleros is where you end up is a crapshoot. But it's a divinely controlled thing. God is the one who's deciding the lot. So let's think about it this way. I think that Paul's theology is, since he's talking about sanctifying you, all of you, spirit, soul, and body, he's talking about that having issue in terms of preservation unto this complete inheritance. Peter says, you have this inheritance laid up for you that fades not away. So the whole idea here is that the kingdom of the Christ is going to have a plethora of participants, each one of whom will have a specific assignment in the kingdom. This will be your job, 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 this will be your job. And it's our understanding, at least my understanding, that the decision about which job you get is going to show up, or it's going to be made manifest at the judgment seat of Christ. Whatever doesn't burn, you're rewarded according to that, and the reward consists of an inheritance, something that you're given because this is the lot. This is the way it worked out. This is what you get. So in a very real sense, the parables where Jesus said, you know, the guy that was faithful over 10 talents, he gets 10 cities. The guy that gets 5 talents, he gets 5 cities. The whole idea there is that there's a connection between our lives lived here and the way they're going to play out in the eschaton. So the issue is that there are all of these participants, millions of them, and there are millions of tasks, and everybody's going to be assigned a task. Paul is saying, I am praying, I am asking, I am desiring that God will preserve you to the ultimate realization of the final inheritance, the kleros. And the nature of the task itself is really determined by the nature of the kingdom. I mean, if the kingdom is going to be poopy horses, there's going to have to be some stable cleaners, unless we come up with robots to do it for us. If the kingdom is an amalgamation of multiple national structures that are being economically prosperous and all that, and they're bringing their produce and stuff into the new city, then there's going to have to be governors and you know, there's going to have to be some people to govern, look at over all of these various and sundry tasks. There are going to have to be some people who do the tasks, and there are going to have to be some people above that to do, you know, the bureaucrats. The church is actually presented in the New Testament as the bureaucracy of the kingdom of the Christ. We're going to rule with him over the kingdom. So the kingdom tasks are determined by the nature of the kingdom. If there are no horses, then we don't have to worry about stables. But the decision as to the who that gets the particular task, that's really a matter of two things the Bible presents in parallel tracks. One of them is the judgment seat of Christ, which is the judgment of the works of the believer, and that has to do with how much of the prior issue has been accomplished. That is, the loves and the faith have been adjusted, and they produce gold, silver, and precious stones. And where there has not been adjustment, there's, you know, wood, hay, and stubble. So that's one of the tracks. Your position in the kingdom is tied to how much you grow in this life in terms of truth and love. But the other track is a divine election, where God says to his 12 disciples, you guys are going to sit over, you're going to sit on the thrones of the 12 tribes of Israel in the regeneration. Well, I thought those jobs went to the ones that are most qualified. They do. You're going to qualify. I'm going to see to it. Okay? So there's these two tracks. There's the track that has to do with a sense of depending on God and letting him change our values and beliefs. And the other is this track of verse 24 where Paul just frankly says, God called you. He's going to do it. So on the one hand, he wants us to live in tension. And the other hand, he wants us to live in peace. They're to come together. The peace that God is going to accomplish it should govern my choices of value and belief so that there's not a lot of tension in that. It's just going along with God on the thing because I believe he's going to bring me to the end that he intended. So, as we already said, the outcome is going to be the result of a very meticulous judgment at the judgment seat of Christ where he's going to check out everything. But at the same time, he's had a plan from way back when who's going to fit where. And it's his job, it's his commitment to bring his children to their place. And this really fits in the whole idea of Paul's large theology. And in this verse, what he's doing is he's wishing for two things. He's wishing for God to be faithful to his commitment to be sanctifying unto the intended end, and to be preserving until you get to the inheritance. Those are his two, in effect, prayers for the Thessalonians. Are they going to be answered? We'll talk about that pretty much next week when we get back to who's going to be doing this. We'll get back to verse 23. May the God of the peace himself do this. So we'll get back to that. But I want you to understand this evening that the issue is that Paul is pulling together two major concepts in relation to our spirit, souls, and bodies, because these are the areas that have to be corrected in terms of values and beliefs. Spirit, soul, body. All three of those carry certain values and beliefs that have to be addressed. That's a big package, a massive job, and Paul's desire is that God will move in sanctification through the whole process until you get to that intended end. And then he adds the idea that may your whole being, soul, spirit, and body, or spirit, soul, and body, be preserved until the fullness of the inheritance has been achieved. That's the statement. That's what I believe is a big part of the backdrop of verse 23. But it's the backdrop that's introduced to us by two words. The halotelos and the halokleros. All the way through to the end, all the way through to the inheritance. And with those two things in mind, Paul is basically, he's winding up his letter. But when you realize, and this part of my thunder for next week, it's the God of peace that's going to do this, not the God of power, not the God of wisdom, not the God of truth, not the God of holiness, the God of peace. I really believe that's a dead giveaway, that 1st and 2nd Thessalonians are written in regard to the soul of man, because that's where the peace issues are going to come mostly to bear. So, God's got a job to do, according to verse 24. And our issue is recognizing that Paul's statement of his wishes that God will do this, and his then turn around and saying he's going to, is to build our confidence that he has in mind for us something that we'll be perfectly satisfied with when we get there. And he's going to make sure we get there.